I'm very happy now to welcome Kurt Shaw. He is executive director of the organization Shine a Light, and he is the director of the film Life's Roulette, Ruleta de la Vida, which has its U.S. premiere on October 30th, this Saturday at the CCA at 1 in the afternoon. It's the world's first film that was written and filmed, directed, and I guess acted also,
yep,
entirely by former child soldiers in Colombia.
In Colombia.
So tell us about how this film got to be made in the first place.
In 2003, I had worked in Colombia with an organization called Taller de Vida, which works with refugee kids and has come to work with child soldiers. Made a film which was about the experience of refugee kids in the school system, looking at ways to modify the school system, to do school reform so that it's more appropriate for the 2 million refugee children in Colombia. When Taller de Vida started to work with child soldiers, they invited me back. They'd started a video program. They'd found that video was a really interesting way to work with kids. And everything else emerged from the kids themselves.
And so these kids, what was their role as child soldiers? How did they get into that in the first place? Who were they?
There's an idea that comes out of a lot of child soldier literature from Africa. Things that I remember Ismael Bey's biography was in Starbucks, for instance, a couple of years ago. And the idea that all child soldiers are recruited involuntarily, that they're forced in. And in fact, that's not true in Colombia. Most of these kids were between 10 and 12 years old. And so, of course, there's a question for us. They've reached the age of reason and can make such decisions.
Right.
But in most cases, they had one of two reasons to join the armed groups. First of all, they had seen so much suffering in their own families, and they saw that the salary of being a child soldier, which is about $300 a month, would be sufficient to buy more food for their younger brothers. So that was one major motivation. Second motivation was that they had seen their families murdered by the other side, and so they joined in order to get revenge. And, of course, like I said, when you're 12 years old, it's really hard to make those sorts of decisions. Nonetheless, most of them said that it was the first adult decision they'd ever made. Then suddenly, they get into the FARC, the Marxist guerrillas, or the ELN, another Marxist guerrilla, or the paramilitaries, and they don't have any choices whatsoever. They are in something that would make even the United States military look like a nice, liberal organization. Just no choices, brutal beatings. Almost all the girls were submitted to rape as an initiation rite. Really horrible, horrible things.
So there were girls who signed up also?
Oh, yeah. Yep. In the FARC is about a third women, or a third female. No, I won't say a third women because many of them are under 18.
And so then they were beaten, they were raped. Then they played the role of soldiers? What did they actually do? What was their role as child soldiers?
Mostly when they started, it would be things like sentry duty, carrying stuff, cooking. Though, in fact, it seems as if being a cook was not a safe position. Most of them described the worst beatings they ever got as when they were cooks. If they burned the food, that was a guarantee of being almost threatened to death. And then as they grew older, they might have entered at 12. By the time they were 13 or 14 or 15, they would be radio operators. They would be coming to carry weapons. And at 16, they were full-fledged soldiers.
And how did they, the ones who made this film, how did they get out of that life? Was there pressure for them to stay in once they were on the inside?
It's not just pressure. It's especially the FARC, if they catch you trying to leave, they'll kill you.
Yeah.
A lot of the stories that we heard were of kids being disenchanted. They would get there, and not only did they not get what they wanted, they didn't get the revenge on the other side. They were brutalized. But their family didn't even get paid. Nonetheless, they can't leave. If they
right.
left, they would be
so much for the $300 a month.
Exactly, and so almost all of them who had been on the two guerrilla groups had to flee. And the stories that we heard of that were just extraordinary. Kids walking two weeks through the jungle, always having to be in uniform to carry their weapons, because when they turned themselves into the police, they had to have their uniform and their weapon in order to confirm that they were
yeah.
they were that. And one kid who who tried to flee one time, was caught, was sentenced to death, escaped a second time by throwing a grenade into the outhouses when the poop flew. Everyone else was so confused that he ran and ended up floating down a river for 2 weeks in order to get to some place where
Good
he... Extraordinary, extraordinary. And what was amazing is that the first day we started to work on the film, we wanted... The films that we'd worked on in the past were... based on the individual stories of kids that we'd worked with in the favelas of Brazil, street kids in Argentina. And so we wanted to do the same thing. Well, let's think about your stories, the stories of what you've gone through, and how can we transform that into a film? They wanted nothing to do with that. And finally, at the end of 8 hours of really hard workshop time, one of the young men who eventually became the protagonist in the film said, "Do you have any idea how hard I tried to get out of the war? And every person who I meet... tries to drag me back in." The military intelligence officers who want to know everything that my armed group was doing. The psychologist who says that I've got to talk through it.
Yeah.
The social worker who does this. The file that has to be there. I'm trying to get out of this. Can I tell another story, please? And so at that point, we did a sort of lesson in literary criticism. Not talking about Derrida and Kristeva or anything like that. But what we did is we looked at the way that stories work. The stories that they had were stories of disenchantment. Stories of somebody who desperately wants something, and once they get it, they discover it's not what they wanted at all. And that can be the story of a child soldier, but it can also be the story of a teenage girl who finds that the boyfriend she doesn't like, or of a college graduate who goes to Wall Street and discovers that it's really a bad place. I mean, all of our lives are filled with that. And so we talked about the Spanish Baroque, where desengaño is it's the same idea. Whether it's lots of other stories. And that became the structure of the story itself.
And so instead of making, because when I first became aware that this film was happening, I thought it was going to be a documentary about child soldiers. And in fact, it's a story that they wrote. It's a fiction. It's a narrative movie.
Exactly. And that's really important. Because what they insisted on and what we discovered is that the fiction is much more truthful than a documentary. A documentary would focus on how much they had suffered. For them, that wasn't the truth of their lives. Not anymore. For them, what was much more important is their capacity to do stuff. Their capacity as thinkers, their capacity to survive in a place that would kill you or me. And they were able to portray that in fiction in a way that they wouldn't be able to portray it in a documentary. You have a documentary, you can imagine what a documentary about child soldiers would be like. Oh, these poor kids, they've been this, they've been that.
And it wouldn't be them as subject, it would be them as the object of the film.
Exactly.
Some filmmaker is narrating it who's never been inside of that life.
And who's interviewing them and who's asking his questions or her questions. Whereas in this case, the questions that come out of it are the questions that matter to the kids.
Very, very interesting. And so you were there during the whole process.
Right.
From the beginning where that one kid says, look, we want to get out of it. And then the light bulb went on and said, okay, let's make this a fiction. Where did it go from there?
At that point, we began to do lots of theater games. Everything from... one of the ones that I found most entertaining was one kid would say an animal that someone was supposed to imitate, and then the second would be, well, what is that animal doing? So we have a cockroach running to hide from the sun. We have a snake playing football. We have a gorilla lifting weights. And so, to a certain degree, it's great just for being comfortable in front of the camera.
And it sounds like fun.
And it's really fun. I mean, that was perhaps the most important thing, is that it's... things are transformed and are ludic again. They're fun again. It's play. There was one time when we went to film the kidnapping scene, and the kids had guns, and they started to play it, guns. And we thought, oh no, our film is becoming a repetition of their lives. It's sort of American liberal fear of playing with guns.
Right.
But what we realized is that they were playing with guns. What had happened is that they were kids who played with guns. They got into an armed group, and the play was all gone.
Yeah.
And so by putting the frame of play again, this is about play. It's not about seriousness.
The way a six-year-old might play with a stick and say this is a gun?
Or that it's a sword, or that it is anything else. The gun is transformed. By putting it in the frame of the movie screen, then it's a toy again.
Very interesting. And so, okay, so then you did these theater games, and then at a certain point, the writing process began.
Which is more a telling process than it is anything else. They began to think about, well, what are, we talked about the idea of desengaño, the idea of the, in the Spanish Baroque, of disenchantment. And so where are places where people have disenchantment? We're in a city. Where are people disenchanted? We were filming in a very poor neighborhood, and so they began to think about where that might happen, whether that's in the lives of gang members, whether that's in the lives of street kids, whether that's in the case of two friends who might join competing gangs and would end up on opposite sides. And that's where the stories came out of.
We're talking to Kurt Shaw about the movie Life's Roulette, Ruleta de la Vida, which is screening this coming Saturday at 1 o'clock at the CCA here in Santa Fe. So you were there the whole time, and then, okay, you go through the editing, you played a large role in the editing, then the film is done. What happens next? What happens to the young people who made it? What happens to the film?
One of the things we're most proud of is that of the 15 kids who made the film, none of them have gone back to join an illegal armed group. Even the Colombian government statistics show that more than half of the kids who try to leave the armed groups end up returning.
It's like recidivism rate to prison is what it sounds like.
Exactly. It's what they know. If you left school at 10 years old and you were carrying a gun for 6 years, those were your formative years. That's what you learned how to do.
Yeah.
And so you get out of that, and there are lots of people who want those skills, whether that's a drug trafficker, or whether that's another armed group, whether that's, in the best of cases, I suppose it's private security companies. But the challenge is, well, how do you get other skills? How do you get the kids committed and passionate about other things? And what was really good about this film, I think, is that it made them passionate about something else. First of all, it made them passionate about making films, and some of them are actually now working in film and Colombian television. But more so,
which is amazing.
It is, yeah. It's stunning. It's Colombia. We're not talking Hollywood.
Yeah, but
nonetheless, it's
they have a television industry,
right? And it's pretty amazing to think that somebody who 2 or 3 weeks before they started to work with us had a gun in their hands, had a camera as a sort of transitional object to, and then is working in Colombian television. I mean, it's pretty cool. But I think even more important, it made them passionate about them, about their friends. There were kids from both sides. It's a really ideological war in Colombia between the right wing and the left wing. And we had kids who'd been in the paramilitaries and kids who'd been in the Marxist guerrillas. And yet they became really good friends. There's a sort of piece of folk wisdom among kids in the armed groups that there are no friends in the armed groups. You can't trust anybody. Somebody's always going to narc on you. Somebody is going to tell the boss. You just can't trust anyone. And also, they might die. I mean, you can't make really good friendships there. And I think for the first time in their adolescent lives, since they'd been little kids, suddenly they had friends again. And it's interesting that when I talk to one or two of them, all of them know where everybody else is. Oh, yeah, Mario, he's gone back to to his family, and things are going really well back there in Yopal. Oh, and Jorge, he's there. And so it's great to know that they became passionate about their friends.
Now, does having made this film give them any kind of immunity from being sought out by the groups that they left?
I don't know if making the film does. I think that what it does more is that it gives them the strength to say that that's not what they want anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, they could be, in theory, sought out and murdered for having left.
They could very much so. And a lot of kids were worried about showing it in Colombia because they didn't want their old comrades to see it. And in fact, we've been very careful that it's only shown in Colombia, places where we know who the audience is going to be. In the rest of the world, we're not quite as worried. But
right.
In Colombia, we were very careful about that.
So you're showing it here this coming Saturday, and they will be there, these filmmakers, live via Skype.
Not everybody, but there are going to be at least a couple of them, probably four or five, who participated in it. And it's great to see the way that those things have changed over 3 years ago that we made the film. The two protagonists, the boy and the girl who fall in love in the film, fell in love in real life.
Really?
They'll be there on Skype with their daughter.
Oh my God, that's so cute!
It is. It's cute, but it also shows something about hope. And the last time I was in Colombia, I talked to them.
And about method acting.
Yeah, right. Exactly. they commented that they're really excited to have made this film because, to a certain degree, it's going to help the world be a place where their daughter won't make the same mistakes they did.
Kurt Shaw is the executive director of the organization Shine a Light, which we didn't even talk about, but we'll get to that maybe another time. We'll have you back. And he's the director of the film Life's Roulette, Ruleta de la Vida, which once again is screening this Saturday, October 30th at 1 o'clock at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Art here in Santa Fe. They're at ccasantafe.org, 982-1338. Kurt Shaw, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take another break. We'll be back in just a second. Please stay tuned. I'd like now to introduce Jennifer Monson. She is a choreographer, and she's the artistic director of ILAND. That stands for Interdisciplinary Laboratory for Art, Nature, and Dance. She will be speaking tonight at Tipton Hall, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. That's at 6 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So I have not yet experienced the work that you do, so lead us a little bit in talking about how you integrate dance and choreography with an attempt to understand the earth and the environment where people are.
I think the best place to start is with the first project that I did that brought me out into this type of environmental work. I've been living in New York City for over 10 years, and I was hanging out at an abandoned industrial site on the Brooklyn waterfront. And there was a broken hydrant, fire hydrant, and an abandoned field that had become a kind of urban wetlands area where migratory birds were stopping through. And I started to think about how migrations tie these global communities together, and also thinking about how animals navigate and their strategies for navigating. And that clicked with me as a way that I was also thinking about my own dancing experience. As a dancer, I move with my proprioceptive senses, especially as an improviser, moving through space with other dancers. And as I began to research animal navigation, that gave me the idea to do this project where I would actually get myself out of the city and literally follow the migrations of animals. So I followed gray whales from Baja California, Mexico, up the Pacific coast to Vancouver Island in Canada, ospreys from their nesting grounds in Maine, down the Atlantic Flyway through Cuba and Venezuela, and then ducks and geese up the Mississippi Flyway.
How did you do that? How did you follow them?
Well, we actually followed in cars. I wish we'd flown or taken boats or something.
Or hot air balloon.
Yeah. But all our performances were outdoors, and I actually did it as an attempt to get in closer contact with the cycles of the seasons, to learn more about celestial navigation, to pay attention to the tidal cycles. I think I had a relatively romantic notion at that point of getting back to nature. And the whole project just led me through a series of redefinitions of what nature means, what sustainability means, what conservation means, what sharing the planet with other animals means. And for some reason, for me, it makes complete sense to figure that out through the body. Like my body moving and dancing through a landscape produces a kind of knowledge of that place that's really particular to an embodied and embedded knowledge of place that's different than painting or photography because it is so experiential.
So you would dance in the landscape?
Yeah, so we would dance along the beaches, the first or in parking lots or schoolyards or through marshes. We were often dancing in national parks or state parks or county parks or in schoolyards.
How many dancers were there doing this together?
I took three additional dancers besides myself, and there was a videographer documenting the project and then sometimes a project manager.
And so how is your dancing different? Like, describe the experience of dancing on a beach versus a parking lot versus a marsh.
The dancing along a beach is really particular because of the sand and the ocean and the wind. It becomes almost, there's a sense of borderlessness between the body and the environment, where I would say dancing in a parking lot or through streets, you're negotiating the built environment in a completely different way. And it's one that we're more familiar maybe with moving through. We're used to walking down sidewalks and crossing streets. But once you start dancing, you're moving through the streets, alongside of cars, changing your level, rolling. It's a quite intimate experience of a space that, you know, is considered dangerous or dirty. So that really shifts my perception of place and of dancing.
And if we were to, say, watch the dancers and take out the background, would we know where you were by the way you were moving?
That's a really excellent question. I've just been looking at the videos now, thinking about what I'm going to show tonight, and going back to look at this project of the gray whale migration, which was in 2000, which was quite a while ago, and I'm even trying to contextualize my work from a piece from 1993, and I'm actually seeing a lot of similarities in the movement, but there is a very different sense of space and timing in the work outdoors. I think often things slow down because there's so much information coming in and the energy spreads out into the space, whereas you're working in a more enclosed space, the energy kind of reverberates and resonates.
As they say, bouncing off the walls.
Exactly, yeah.
So you said a moment ago that you redefined your sense of nature from a romanticized concept of getting back to nature to something else. Tell us about that process.
So I actually, one reason I'm extremely happy to be here in Santa Fe is I grew up spending a lot of time in the high desert in Southern California. So I think my early experiences of dancing were navigating and climbing around, scrambling through these flesh-colored rocks. The place where I spent time was very near Joshua Tree National Monument. So I think I had a very special sense of being alone in a pretty pristine and untouched wilderness place. And I think living in New York, I began to feel sort of bereft and somewhat hopeless about the condition of the world, how quickly it was changing, that my children would never experience something that I had experienced. And I think I had a kind of like a holding a place in time of what that was wilderness. But of course, what wilderness is constantly changing, especially in our sort of American psyche. So actually, you know, this urban wetlands with the broken fire hydrant, I began to see that, oh, this was just as much nature and just important on this navigational flyway as any other part. And then my next project after this bird brain migration was in an abandoned reservoir on the border of Brooklyn and Queens. So here's a built landscape, was built in 1860, that's been abandoned and drained, and there's pretty much what one would consider a completely native habitat that's taken hold in this empty reservoir that's like the swamp forest you'd find out further on Long Island, but it's, you know, replaced itself in this, you know, this place it wouldn't be. It's on the top of the terminal moraine of the Wisconsin ice sheet. It's quite high, but there's still this swamp in it. So those kind of, that kind of resilience and fragility of those systems really inspire me. And I think dance is particularly useful for, well, just because I am a dancer, but looking at relationships of scale and temporal and spatial relationships as well. Something like this reservoir, researching it from kind of geologic perspective and then the kind of immediate presence of the space in relation to all the urban citizens that take advantage of it.
We're talking to choreographer Jennifer Monson. So how does the work you do translate into the community? In other words, the non-dancers, the audiences who might encounter your work?
So I'll use the example of this Ridgewood Reservoir project again. As part of my research, I invited the Brooklyn Bird Club to come in and do a nesting bird count, and local botanists and fish biologists. So there was that kind of scientific research. I introduced people to the reservoir that hadn't been familiar with it before. And then during the time that we were doing the project, the city decided to develop this reservoir site as a regional park and fill it and make ball fields. But the Brooklyn Bird Club was so excited that they'd found 60 acres of urban wilderness that was a really essential migratory route for migrating birds. And so they started a community group that has been successful in putting a moratorium on the development of the site. So there's kind of immediate activist outflow of that project. We also included 8 young Chinese dancers from a dance school in Elmhurst, Queens, and they presented work that we choreographed together in our June performances. And then people from the neighborhood could come and walk around the perimeter of the reservoir, and we had sort of docents that could talk about the dance, could talk about native plants, could talk about the birds, could talk about the architectural history of the reservoir. And I collaborated with some architects who set up these nice areas for the audience to sit and get more information and talk to people. So there are many ways to bring the audience into this experimental dance form that might seem sort of odd at first, but there were people who could encourage them and ask them questions about their experience with the project as well.
One of my favorite books of all time is Isadora Duncan's autobiography. And at the very beginning, she was so poor that she never had babysitters or anything like that. And she said that she learned to dance from the Pacific Ocean and the sky and the trees. And I love that idea that the rest of nature is teaching us how to move. Do you have that kind of experience of learning from nature itself?
Absolutely. In my studies, I've touched into a form called Body Mind Centering by Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen, and she talks about the development of the embryo. And so she talks about that's the movement of the cell that creates development. So from the very beginning, it's movement that allows us to grow. And I think that my own experience of moving as a dancer in the studio and experiencing that evolution of an internal awareness with the external environment has been really important. And that we just finished a project on the New York City watershed, and every day we spent 15 minutes or so just witnessing the water. And I feel like over time, that experience of just witnessing the water on the New York City harbor, which every day was completely different, had a quite profound physical experience inside of me and in the way that I'm dancing now.
It sounds like it's so related in a certain way to meditation, where you focus on the breath or you focus on some object of contemplation that has a steadiness to it but is also always changing.
Yes, I think that's really true. And there's something I'm looking at now between how you engage in watching someone else dance and how you engage in the intimacy of experience a landscape. And I think there's some interconnectedness between the empathy and emotional connections we make with each other and with landscape and the stories that landscapes tell and the stories that bodies hold. And my last project, this one on New York City watershed, has a very intimate one-on-one relationship with the performer and the audience, where we tried to develop a kind of system where you were both watching your partner and watching the whole group and the landscape at the same time. So that's I think, quite appropriate that you picked up on that, this kind of contemplative moment of perception and perceiving empathy with other and with place.
And yeah, and you start to see the relationship between water, self, dance, landscape, other.
Yeah.
In a way that you wouldn't normally.
Yeah, and I've also been so interested in these different productions of knowledge or ways of knowing the world, because I myself am so drawn to scientific understandings, with the bird brain migration, hanging out with folks who were doing satellite tracking of the ospreys and of gray whales and learning about native plants and the water cycle and stream restoration projects. And I feel like I'm trying to lay out a kind of a sharing of that kind of knowledge, which is why I set up ILAND to support that kind of interdisciplinary creative process.
Jennifer Monson is a choreographer and artistic director of ILAND, which can be found on the web at ilandart.org. And once again, she'll be speaking tonight at Tipton Hall, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute. That's at 6 o'clock. You can go to sfai.org or call 505-424-5050. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.